From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C., our old stomping ground. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you, our listeners. We're very grateful for that support. Never do we take it for granted. Today, as the world around us changes in unsettling and unexpected ways, it is more important than ever to provide this platform for thoughtful, respectful dialogue and voices that all too often go unheard. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, April 9th is the Christian observance of Palm Sunday. Monday brings the Jain Mahavir Jayanti, and Hindus mark Hanuman Jayanti on Tuesday, which also brings the start of the Jewish Passover and the Buddhist Theravadan New Year. At the intersection of religion, government, and politics, an extreme interpretation of religious liberty in the form of an executive order continues to gather support. This week, 18 Senate Republicans wrote to the president urging him to formalize language that would inevitably protect discrimination in the name of religious liberty. Lawmakers in North Carolina finally repealed the notorious bathroom bill. Among the rewards of making that change is an end to the NCAA's boycott of the state. But activists say the repeal didn't go nearly far enough to cancel all the related damage done to LGBT rights in the state. An appeals court has fast-tracked review of the newest version of the Trump Muslim travel ban. We can expect a hearing sometime in May. And BuzzFeed is reporting that weeks before Donald Trump's first Muslim travel ban executive order was ever issued, his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, held an extensive meeting with leading American Muslim groups. The revelation sheds a curious light on the way the administration has gone on to treat followers of Islam since then. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
Just hours ago, Washington watched a swearing-in for our country's new ambassador-at-large for international religious freedom, a rabbi by the name of David Saperstein.
Rabbi David Saperstein has just concluded his tenure as ambassador-at-large for international religious freedom, a position to which President Obama nominated him in 2014. As the first non-Christian to hold that position, as well as a lifelong activist, author, and attorney who headed up the Union for Reform Judaism's Religious Action Center for over 30 years, David is uniquely qualified to offer a dispassionate evaluation of the state of religious freedom around the globe today and to comment on the likely role of the United States going forward. We'll spend the second half of this week's show going over all of that.
There's reason to be skeptical. If you're a good reporter, I would think a reason to be skeptical about all this. So trying to make judgments and, you know, ask us to make final pronouncements on things that we frankly don't know are facts is a little bit bizarre.
First, though, I'm joined by Mike McCurry, who served as presidential press secretary during some of the most contentious moments in recent political history. As the face of the White House from 1994 to 1998, Mike was faced with questions the like of which few of his predecessors could even imagine. After a 35-year career in national politics, most recently Mike McCurry has been serving as professor and director at the Center for Public Theology at Wesley Theological Seminary. As the relationship between the current administration and the press continues to deteriorate, It's a rare privilege to be able to draw upon Mike McCurry's experience and expertise. And so, Professor McCurry, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
I'm humble enough to be chagrined at being called professor, but I appreciate the honorific.
Well, you've got it and you deserve it. What comes to your mind first when you look at the relationship between the White House and the press as it is today?
Well, the first thing that comes to my mind is it is by definition an adversarial relationship. Let me tell you a little bit about the geography at the White House in the West Wing. I think people are always fascinated by that. But the press secretary's office in the West Wing is exactly halfway between the Oval Office and then that briefing room where we often see the press secretary do the briefings for the press. And that is a metaphor for the job. You're halfway between the protagonists in this adversarial relationship with you got to keep the president happy, articulating the president's policies, but you actually also have to serve the press because they're there to be watchdogs and to hold accountable the people who are in power. And if you can't keep both sides of that equation basically happy, they're never going to be totally happy, then you're probably not going to be doing very well in the job.
So you can imagine the level of rancor that's going on right now in national politics?
Well, it's a despairing thing. And I'm now in the official business of praying about such things because I've never seen that level of acrimony and that level of contentiousness. And that worries me because, at some levels, when I was there, I had plenty of screaming matches with reporters and I didn't like what they were writing sometimes and they probably didn't like the way I was giving answers sometimes. But we basically could work through our differences and get through the day. And at the end of the day, you'd kind of go home and sort of say, okay, well, everybody did their job today. And I don't know that that's happening right now. And I think that's a real troubling thing for me that the people are – largely dissatisfied with this equation, and I think that's a troubling thing for us.
I don't mean to be redundant, but what do you think is causing this? What's different?
Well, there's a lot of differences. My daughter reminds me often that, well, Dad, you were famous as press secretary, but that was the last century.
It sounds
like a daughter, but it's a very telling comment because we did not have social media and Twitter and instantaneous access. We still had kind of a mainstream press that most people watched, tuned into to learn what was going on in the White House. And if you could, gather people together and get everyone to sort of have some basic level of understanding, most Americans would at least understand what was going on at the White House. Now everything is so fragmented and people are off into their own little universe of whatever websites or social media sites they go to or whatever information they get. Nobody's got this common base of knowledge. We don't gather around a common campfire with the griot sort of pronouncing what the community needs to know. And I think that's a big, big change. And it's driven by technology, driven by changes in the media, and frankly driven by some of the divisions and polarization that exist in our politics right now. And it's a troubling time.
I suspect there are things that the president, the press, and the public each lose in the midst of a toxic dynamic like we're experiencing now. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I agree. I think the main thing we lose is trust in our institutions. If you look, there's some great research done by the Pew Research Center, and they show that we are at an all-time low in trust of institutions, and it is across the board. It's organized religion.
It is.
Churches, small business, labor, the only institutions that rank high in public trust are the military because they are just so exceptionally good at what they do. But most
and
of
nurses.
The and nurses.
Nurses are at the top.
Although hospitals, medical, the doctors, they have lost a lot of credibility. So the glue that holds our civil society together is really missing in a lot of cases. And I think that's You know, that's something that I think the church needs to respond to. Mm-hmm. I think we all need to think about what are the things that draw us together and keep us together as one body. Mm-hmm. And we don't have many discussions like that, or particularly in Washington where we are now, where everything is so polarized and divided.
I'm not asking for a critique. I think I'm asking more for an observation about how you feel about the role the political press is playing in the presidential campaign and now in the White House.
Well, you know, it's a hard question because the political press, as I mentioned earlier, has become completely disaggregated. In my time in the 1990s, there were a handful of very influential reporters, and they represented what we call the mainstream media, New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, you know, the major networks, a handful of others. And more or less, if that community came together to report a story, 90% of the country would have some access to it. Mm-hmm. We don't have that anymore because people are not tuning into any kind of mainstream news source. They kind of find the places where they are feel more comfortable. It very often confirms the bias that they have. We have what's called confirmation bias in the way in which people access news. So they only go and camp out in the places where they're kind of having their own views reinforced. And I think that makes a very, very difficult environment. Now, that said, there's extraordinarily good journalism done. Mm-hmm. And one of my strongest objections to our current president is when he calls the media dishonest. They're all dishonest. They're all bad. Well, then that impugns the integrity of people who I know. I know these reporters, and I know that most of them, you know, they may have their biases. In fact, most of their biases are socioeconomic. They actually came out of good Ivy League schools. They're smart. They've had privileged backgrounds. So they do have a little bit of that bias. But they're not politically biased. I mean, if there's a liberal bias in the media, I sure wish it had showed up when I was there. It would have made my life a lot easier. Yeah. But, they try to do the job of reporting about what's going on. But when they are castigated and when people then doubt their integrity because the chief executive of the land says that they're dishonest, well, then we're eroding anything that kind of establishes a way in which we do business together. And that's just deeply troubling to me.
You had experiences of shouting matches with the media. How did you resolve that?
Well, a little bit of grace and the ability to ask for forgiveness if you got a little too overheated, and then recognition that everyone has a job. It's a very adversarial, contentious environment, and the press secretary always is going to have fights with the media that cover because you're never going to be totally happy with what gets reported. But at the end of the day, you know, the reporters would come up at the end of the day. Now, we had a different environment then. We had a news cycle. There was an ebb and flow. It wasn't this constant 24/7. You have to be tweeting nonstop all night long. It wasn't that kind of environment. So at the end of the day, we'd come up and I'd crack open a bottle of bourbon sometimes. Proved to be a good strategy.
I'm sure that goes good with grace.
Yes. And we'd sit together and just kind of talk off the record and clear the air.
Yeah.
And so we could go back and do battle the next day. And sometimes we'd just be equally fierce in doing battle the next day. But there was a harmony there because there was both sides recognized a professional obligation to keep focused on the most important thing, which is the American people need to have the truth. Mm-hmm. Now, most White Houses say if you just reported the truth about what we're doing, then we'd be fine because everyone would appreciate how great the president is and all the good things that we're doing. So, and the press would say, well, if you would just give us truthful, accurate information, we would be able to report the truth to the American people and we'd be happy. Yeah. So in theory, both sides want the same thing, but it's when those things, you know, come in conflict that you get this contentious environment. But at the end, the truth matters. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, you probably saw the Time magazine cover recently, and you and I are old enough to remember that Is God Dead was a cover on Time magazine.
Absolutely.
And their recent cover was Is Truth Dead?
Yeah.
Well, if truth is dead, we are all dead. And I think that You know, that's pretty profound.
Yes, it is.
Question to ask.
Do you see any quick solution to what's going on right now? And are we making too big a deal about this?
Well, no, we're not making too big a deal, because these are fundamentally important to whether our little noble experiment in self-government called the United States of America is going to continue to last.
And it has to do with truth.
Because it has to do with truth. It has to do with people having good information that they can use to make decisions and knowing where to go to kind of sort out fact from fiction.
Yeah. So do you see any quick solutions?
Well, I've two. One is to slow down. You know, the news media has always competed on the basis of speed. How fast can you get to breaking news? You know, like breaking news. Mm-hmm. Here's the breaking news. But sometimes we need to slow down and sort of let's get the facts right and let's value that. And we as consumers of news and information have to value that. Mm-hmm. So if you have to pay a little more money to get some product that's actually going to say, I know I've heard all this stuff that's on the internet, on the radio, on the TV, but I know there's one place that I can go that will sort it all out for me. And then when I read that, I'll know I've got the facts. Mm-hmm. Now that to me is journalism. Yeah. And we journalists, frankly, news organizations have gotten away from that primary responsibility to present facts, because they're now getting all caught up in the opinion business. Yeah. And the other thing, and this is important, I spent some time on this, is to teach young people how to be what we call news literate. Young people, as they come up, you know, baby boomers, we've kind of made our bed and we sleep in it. But young people who are coming up, if they can learn the techniques to be discerning in where they go to get information, I have kids who are in their 20s now, and they're very pragmatic. You know, they are not particularly ideological. You know, they don't follow the liberal politics of their dad the time. So they think on their own, but they are looking and seeking. You know, what's the real story on something? I mean, I get emails from my kids all the time. And, Dad, what's the real deal on such and such or this or that? And they want to, you know, they don't want to know what my view or opinion is. Yeah. They just want to know, like, they're trying to sort out what fact and fiction is. Yeah. And I think if we can solve that problem by giving people sources that they trust, content that they trust, then we kind of rebuild a consensus around, okay, here are the facts, and then we can begin to sort out what our opinions are.
I want to switch gears for a moment. How did you get to Wesley Theological Seminary?
Well, it was a good, strong local pastor. So during my time at the White House, I actually did not work on Sundays. I took some good advice I got one time, which is never go on the Sunday talk shows, you know, stay away from them. And so Sunday literally became my Sabbath. I took Sunday off. I don't think folks at the White House have that luxury anymore, and that's too bad. But I, you know, I'd get up, I'd go to church. We live fortunately right across the street from our church, so we never had an excuse to bail out on meetings or worship services. Yeah. So, you know, we'd go over, and it was a safe sanctuary for me. It was a quiet place, and my fellow members of my congregation were graceful and left me alone. They didn't ask me, like, hey, what about the White House this week? Because I was in the news. You know, they would see me on news pretty much every night. Sure. But they gave me a very, very safe space. And over time, I kind of, you know, so I when I left the White House, actually, I left the White House in 1998, and my senior pastor came to me and said, well, now we're glad you're done with that because we have a real job for you. And I said, wait a minute, I thought I just had a real job. And it ended up they wanted me to become the superintendent of our Sunday school at church. Mm-hmm. And I was very flattered by that. And I said, well, I'm just so delighted that you asked me to do this. I said, how did you happen to think that this was the right job for me? And Chet Kirk, our pastor, said, well, Mike, we haven't been able to get anyone to do that job for about 10 years. So it was a case where the, you know, the job sought me out, and it was a great experience. And so I had to teach middle school. I tell you, if you want the most challenging assignment at a church is to teach middle school, Sunday school. And I realized I needed more information. So I went and got involved at Wesley Seminary, took some courses that help equip lay leaders, went on their board of governors, got really involved in things there, got, you know, one day someone said, why don't you take courses here? And I ended up getting a master's degree in theology. And then now was recruited to become a member of their faculty doing some work in politics and religion. But it's been a wonderful way to blend what I think is the most important thing, which is how does faith respond to issues in the public square? Yeah. So it's kind of combining my interest both in faith and in politics.
You know, Mike, and I'm sure this is true for you too, I am deeply concerned about what the torrid divisions in politics, and especially on Capitol Hill in the White House, what that's doing to people's understanding of government and civility and how we go forward. And so maybe one of the most important questions I will ask you today is this last one. Where do you get your hope?
Well, I get my hope from young people. They are not rigidly ideological. There, many of them are political. Mm-hmm. Some of them are political and they don't know it. They're involved in community organizing and volunteering to do things in their communities, and they're changing the face of their communities by the work that they do. And they disconnect that from what we would think of as electoral politics, because they think, frankly, electoral campaign politics is kind of yucky. Yeah. And they want to be a part of it. Yeah. But as I tell my kids and tell others, I say, well, you know, you are about changing the face of the way in which our community works. And so you need to stand up, and frankly, you need to begin taking power away from the baby boomers who have put us in this position of gridlock and partisanship. We're sitting here, we're two gray-haired guys, you know, who probably have fewer years ahead of us than behind us. And my hope is that the young people who are coming along begin to reject some of this partisanship and division and begin to find ways to work with each other. And I see enormous opportunities that give me hope, because I see young Christian evangelicals who care about the environment. They want to be good stewards of God's creation, working with younger, more progressive liberal kids on climate change and issues like that. I see a lot of interest in poverty. You know, people just understand that it's wrong for people to be hungry in America of all countries, and they're working together on things like that. So I take great hope that the change will be generational. It might take longer than we hope, but, you know, at the end, I'm very hopeful that the kingdom of God is, you know, in front of us and coming.
Mike McCurry is professor and director at the Center for Public Theology at Wesley Theological Seminary. Previously, his career in national politics spanned three decades and included 4 years as press secretary to President Bill Clinton from 1994 through 1998. Professor McCurry, I'm very grateful for you spending time with us today on State of Belief Radio.
That's great, and thank you for having me.
Rabbi David Saperstein was the U.S. Ambassador at Large for International Religious Freedom during the final 2 years of the Obama administration. Prior to that important position, David led the Union for Reformed Judaism's Religious Action Center for over 30 years. For many years, he has also been an active member of Interfaith Alliance and its board of directors. Now back at the RAC, in the role of senior advisor, David Saperstein brings a breadth and depth of knowledge that few other people have. And I'm very happy to be able to welcome him to State of Belief. David, it's great to see you.
Always a pleasure to talk with you, Walton.
You had a unique position from which to view religious liberty issues around the globe. As you look back, would you say the general trend in relation to religious freedom is more positive, or is it more negative?
It's inconsistent. The Pew research arm does a calculation and evaluation of what the trends are year after year. So using consistent patterns is able to give us some insight into this. The good news is about 75% of the countries in the world do not have any kind of serious restrictions on religious freedom or societal hostilities that interfere with religious communities' ability to live their lives openly and freely. The bad news is that amongst the countries that have either social hostilities or government infringement on religious freedom are included some of the most populous countries in the world. China, obviously, would fit into that. Nigeria and Egypt and Pakistan. India has societal issues, et cetera. So there are the numbers of people, they say about 75% of the world's population lives in countries that have serious restrictions on religious freedom. In some countries, things are getting better. In some countries, they are getting worse. And there's clear reasons for the pattern of where they are getting worse, and that is a central challenge for us to address those underlying sources of the deterioration.
David, what is the role of American diplomacy in advancing religious freedom?
The United States, first of all, is a driving force on this issue. In part, it has to do with our history, that religious freedom was a founding principle of America. In our Constitution's ban on religious tests for office, its promise of free exercise of religion, and its bar against any law even respecting a government establishment of religion, a revolutionary concept was implemented for the first time in human history. For America was the first country that promised that your rights as a citizen would not depend upon your religious identity, your religious beliefs, your religious practices. And like many of our promised rights, it took us a long time to get there. Yeah. But by the middle of the 20th century, the 1930s, 40s, 50s, the Supreme Court was coming down with a range of strong court decisions that really made this possible. And we saw groups like Jews, who often have been subject to quotas in universities, in businesses, barred from country clubs, here moved from the peripheries of American society to the very center of American societies. The Supreme Court, and then backed by Congress, asserted the rights of women and the rights of minorities, including Catholics and Jews and agnostics and disabled and dissenters, to participate fully and equally in American society. And we're not there yet, but on the level of religious freedom, it really has been an extraordinary revolution on this idea. And the ideas while this was happening was exactly the period that the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the International Covenant of Civil and Political Rights were being drafted. And America's vision of these ideas infused much of the powerful human rights values and ideals that were implemented in those treaties. So America's played an important role. I was very encouraged that we were able to continue during the time of my tenure in working with the Canadian government. There was an ambassador for religious freedom. We shaped an international contact group of over 30 countries working together to make a priority of fighting for religious freedom. And there is a similar coalition of about 65 caucuses and parliaments. We're talking in both these groups. There are countries with majority religions of every major religion in the world, different continents, very diverse groups. We share in common this belief that people should be able to live freely and safely, alone and in community with those who share their beliefs on the core issues of conscience that religious freedom protects.
I'd like for you to talk about one particular place in the world where U.S. participation had a positive impact.
You know, there are a range of things that one could cite. There are interfaith efforts that many people don't know. It's not just the diplomacy. And what is known somewhat for everyone who follows the field and the general public is the fact that there is built into the international religious freedom structure our designation every year of countries of particular concern against whom economic sanctions can be imposed. the sanctions against Iran, they weren't affected by the nuclear deal, and they remain in place here. And there are sanctions on a number of countries as well. What people don't know that much about is we also invest, the United States government, significantly in programmatic activity that is aimed at building an infrastructure of religious freedom and tolerance and understanding and pluralism, interfaith cooperation, as it does more broadly on human rights. So in the time that I was there, both the secretary and the leadership of the State Department and the administration, but also the Congress, was extraordinarily supportive of our efforts. My budget doubled. My staff doubled. The program money increased fivefold from $3.5 million to $20 million. And we use those monies to support interfaith efforts like those that helped tamp down the violence in Burma when it exploded a few years ago in Mictila and in Mandalay, or in the Central African Republic a year later. And a remarkable interfaith coalition at Time Magazine held up as the group of them, though among the 100 most important people in the world, because they helped tamp down the ethnic and religious violence at the time. I was in the courtroom in Khartoum when two of the most prominent religious prisoners were released by a court, as a court had released Miriam Ibrahim, who was accused of blasphemy just a year before I came on, because many of us had been advocating on her behalf. Many of the activists credit the United States' engagement on this issue and our presence in the country on this issue as one factor that contributes to that. And if I had to lift up anything, I think that the government of Vietnam deserves a lot of credit for rewriting their own law on religious freedom. They didn't have actually a law. It's the first time they wrote it, and engaging with their own religious communities in several drafts of the law and with the international community, and really listened and absorbed and adopted many of the recommendations that the international community brought to bear, and the U.S. played a leadership role in this. They still have very serious problems that exist, but this was a major improvement that will make life better for millions of people and allow us now and Vietnam not only to applaud what has been good in what they've achieved, but to focus on the outstanding issues of deconcern that we continue to hope there will be more improvement on.
So, David, what happens now? And I say that in such a somber way because during the presidential election campaigns, we saw evidence that there was a lot of weak understanding about religious freedom, and then some direct blows to religious freedom that would be breaking our constitutional commitments. So what happens now?
First, on the international level, I remain, even though in these initial couple of months, there have been indications that the administration may not be as vigorous on the human rights front in general, as prior Republican and Democratic administrations have been. Yeah. And I think that would be a setback for United States interests and United States values, should that turn out to be true, but it remains to be seen. But what I do believe is that international religious freedom enjoys such staunch support from Democrats and Republicans, from the left and the right, from liberals and moderates and conservatives, wall-to-wall support, that the Religious Freedom Office will remain a robust office. An ambassador at large will be appointed to succeed me, and I suspect and hope that it will be somebody of significance. In the meantime, there's an extraordinary staff in the office there, and they continue to further America's interests and values every day in the ongoing work they do with countries all across the world on behalf of religious freedom.
Obviously, you were still in that office after Election Day, and you were carrying on the kind of great work that you'd been doing. Did you sense any fear in the international community about what was going to happen?
Throughout 2016, as I traveled across the globe and would talk to government officials and civil society leaders about America's concerns about the plight, almost always, of religious minorities, infringements on religious freedom happen either because the government is secular and constrains religion in general, or the government is comprised primarily of one religious group and minority groups tend to suffer, or where there are authoritarian regimes in general and who are frightened by people's ability or willingness or commitment to organizing their lives around principles, religious ideas and practices mm-hmm. and customs in a peaceful way that nonetheless the government may not be able to fully control. All of those reasons exist. And wherever I went, I would talk about how minorities were being treated. I would hear repeatedly throughout 2016, well, what about your own country? Isn't it hypocritical to criticize us when Muslims are being mistreated in the United States mm-hmm. And the hate crimes have risen mm-hmm. And the president-elect is talking about a ban on Muslims. What's the difference? And this wasn't just me. This was ambassadors throughout the country. It was our extraordinary United States representatives to the Muslim world and to the Organization of Islamic Cooperation. Mm-hmm. Our people who did that were just great. And we would all bring the same message. Every country has problems. But if you look at the United States, the number of hate crimes as a proportion of our population compared to other countries facing similar challenges is very small. A much higher percentage of them are just rhetorical or things written on buildings, comparatively few physical attacks on people, and actual destruction of property. Every one of those that does happen are terrible. The fact that we are smaller in number does not mean we shouldn't respond to every single one of them. And that is what our country does. When these things happen, the political leadership of the country comes out and condemns it. The religious leadership and its strong interfaith coalitions that exist in almost every city. And Welton, you deserve a lot of credit for being inspiration, not just in what you achieved in Interfaith Alliance building it and Jack Moline carries on today, but inspiring many other communities around the country. Mm. And you and I went and spoke to some of those communities together. And it was extraordinary what goes on. Yeah. And so something, an attack on synagogues, Muslims and Christians come out and Baha'is and Buddhists and Hindus to clean up graffiti, to stand in solidarity, to repair damage. And when a mosque is attacked, the synagogues and churches offer their buildings where mosques have been damaged. This is an extraordinary country in its strong interfaith commitment, the pluralism, the respect that goes on, the fact that these are an anomaly out of the 330 million Americans, you know, to have less than 1,000 hate crimes, most of them not physical violence against any one group. It's terrible. It happens. Everyone is terrible, but it has to be seen with some perspective. And I think in the main that most people we spoke to understood at the end of those explanations of lifting up the reality of America, that America still remains a shining example of religious pluralism and respect and cooperation. We are, after all, the most religiously diverse country in the history of the human race. Sociologists tell us that 2,000 religions and sects and denominations, many of them very small and some strange to others, and yet there is enormous tolerance and respect for religion, for religious leaders, for religious organizations, and between religious groups in this remarkable country.
We've seen a shocking rise in anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. Is this at all tied to the rhetoric of the past election?
Polling data has indicated that there are millions of people in the United States who hold racist, anti-Semitic, anti-Muslim views. The number of people has fallen since the end of World War II through the 1990s, in part because of the rise of education. Mm-hmm. And we all know exceptions that exist on college campuses, on particularly politicized racism and anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. But in the main, the higher your level of education, the less likely you are to hold racist, anti-Semitic, anti-Muslim attitudes. That has been an extraordinary advance. But there are still tens of millions who hold those views. Yeah. A shrinking number, a shrinking percentage, but there's still tens of – the extraordinary thing about America was the cultural and social constraints against expressing that. It was relegated to the fringes of American society. This was an extraordinary period from the end of World War II until recent days in this regard. Mm-hmm. And again, the fact that we talk about an increase of 60% in hate crimes of Muslims, but it went from, you know, 280 to 390. Jews, that had about double that number, went from 700 and something to 900 and so. I mean, we don't know the exact number when it's sorted out what this will be. This is a bad period.
Yeah.
And one of the things that happened in this election campaign, the confluence of two factors. One is the anonymity of social media. It has allowed people who would have been under social and cultural constraints against voicing something openly to do it anonymously. Mm-hmm. And our social media is permeated with hate speech and prejudicial speech. And this is deeply alarming. But then in the last race, there were candidates who ran, and I include the President of the United States, who engaged in coarse rhetoric that demeaned people by the groups they were in, that demeaned people individually. He broke through a lot of the taboos. He legitimized for many people the expression of ideas and feelings that heretofore they wouldn't have done and wouldn't have acted on. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that they harbored those in their heart, we needed, and you devoted much of your life to engaging people, including those who had differing views, to try and change them through interaction and engagement and deeper understanding. We had to do that, even with people who didn't express it. But the result is that the public arena today is filled with messages that wouldn't have happened before. Mm-hmm. The social media is very hard to reverse. The President of the United States could do extraordinary things in helping to reverse this, to delegitimize this, to say whatever happened in the past, enough. This is not America. Yeah. This is not what we stand for. This is not what we are about. I've said this, that I'm committed to being the president of all people, and I am going to manifest and express that now. Without the president, it will be very hard to go back in the direction. We won't go back for a while, no matter what happens, but in the direction we were. But the president, more than any other single person, can make a contribution to greatly heal a number of the wounds that have been inflicted over these last year, 18 months.
When you look at these issues, the bigotry issues, you look at it from the perspective of a religious leader and as a lawyer. Mm-hmm. Does that make a difference?
Perhaps in the sense that we're always looking for ways to enhance religious freedom, and that requires legal steps. We all work together to pass the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. I think it has worked significantly to enhance religious freedom in this country. What we didn't see was that the religious freedom claims would be used to claim there is religious justification for individuals to discriminate against other protected categories in the United States. This is a serious challenge. I think the courts in general have been right where they have consistently said that protecting the civil rights claims of protected categories, women, African Americans, led to national origin, Latino, Asian Americans, religious groups of all kinds, and growingly the LGBT community, that defending those religious rights is a compelling interest that can limit religious freedom claims. I think within that, there are ways to accommodate individuals who don't wish to participate or do things, so long as people are being served in a timely manner without any awkwardness or embarrassment. I think there are ways to balance these things out. I just want to say another word on it, though, Welton. I think those of us who share my view about the importance of the civil rights claims also have to recognize how sincerely so many of the people who are making religious claims feel about some of the things that they are arguing they don't want to be implicated in, they don't want to be complicit in. These are important debates to have in American society. I take every one of them seriously, and I really am working hard with many others on all sides of the religious spectrum and political spectrum to see where there's common ground that can diffuse some of the angst over this. But I pray for the day that the kind of religious freedom claims that I had encountered across the globe, where I saw people who were being put in jail for their religious beliefs, who were being tortured, what ISIL and Boko Haram and al-Shabaab were doing in kidnapping people and raping women and forcing them to marry others and forcibly converting people, cutting off heads of believers of their own faith who disagreed with their interpretation of their own religion. When I see the brutality, the persecution, the oppression that so many millions of people do, I pray for the day when the kind of debates that we have all across the globe will be whether or not corporations have free exercise rights and how to most appropriately balance out legitimate competing claims of religious freedom and other civil rights claims. We should keep perspective and a great deal of pride about the fact that we don't have the problems that others have across the globe. And those millions and millions of people, and every religion is oppressed and persecuted somewhere, they need America. They need us working together on their behalf.
Rabbi David Saperstein is Senior Advisor at Union for Reform, Judaism's Religious Action Center. He just completed his term as U.S. Ambassador-at-Large for International Religious Freedom. David, this has been so insightful. Thank you for doing it again today on State of Belief.
Well, thank you, Welton, for everything you've done throughout your career. You've made this country a better place.
Thank you, sir. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. We're counting on you now more than ever, and quite frankly, so are many listeners who aren't able to find the voices that we amplify week after week anywhere else. We have to have this show on the air. If you've heard something that you found to be helpful, I urge you to share that with others who might also benefit from hearing it. It's really easy to do on Facebook and Twitter. Direct them to stateofbelief.com, where they'll find full episodes, an in-depth archive, extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. That's at stateofbelief.com. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. Our terrific producer is Ray Kirstein. We're in Washington, D.C. this week for the Interfaith Alliance Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Awards, honoring broadcaster Diane Rehm and constitutional activist Keyser Khan. Be sure to join us next week for highlights from that celebration, plus more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on.